You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
We planned this occasion mark the death last year of Clyde Snow, the forensic anthropologist who launched that form of evidence gathering with respect to human rights abuses. I had the privilege of knowing Clyde Snow and working with Clyde Snow. And before I introduce the others here, I just want to say a word about that. If you're interested in Clyde Snow, there was a very good book published quite a long time ago in 1991. It's called The Stories Bones Tell, Witnesses from the Grave. It's written by Christopher Joyce and Eric Stover. Eric, who then directed the science program for the American Association for the Advancement of Science, wanted to make a scientific contribution to the trials that took place in Argentina of the generals who had been members of the three military juntas that ruled while many thousands of disappearances took place. And he brought Clyde Snow to Argentina, and Clyde Snow began the process there of exhuming graves often of people buried without identification, and helping to identify those who had been killed, and then determining how they had died. And I want to tell one story that is told in this book, but it's the testimony by Clyde Snow in the trial of the generals that I remember particularly, and that many people in Argentina remember. He testified that one of the skeletons he exhumed belonged to a young woman named Liliana Pereira, and he had been able to verify that it was her skeleton, in part because of the dental records. He told the court that Liliana Pereira had been killed with a shot to the head, but that she had been killed immediately after she gave birth. The court wanted to know how he could tell that she had been killed at that point, and he testified about the way in which the pelvic bones had opened up to allow her to give birth. And that was one of the ways that Argentines learned that when young women who were pregnant were among those who were disappeared, they were kept alive until they gave birth, the child was then taken from them. The child was given to a military family wanting to adopt a child, and then the young woman was executed. And that testimony helped to engrave on the memories of many Argentines, the cruelty of the military rule that had taken place in Argentina. Clyde Snow, in the process of working in Argentina, had collaborated with some students who became his aides in the exhumations, and then formed the Argentine forensic team. And the Argentine forensic team still today plays a leading role, or the leading role, in forensic exhumations worldwide, and has contributed immensely to to the evidentiary quality of human rights information. Most recently, they have been engaged in Mexico in trying to determine what happened to the 43 students who disappeared. Another outgrowth of the work of Clyde Snow is the Guatemalan Forensic Anthropology Foundation, which is directed by Freddy Pecciarelli, who you saw in the film that that just took place. And then sitting next to Freddy is Paco de Onís, who is the producer of the film that you just saw. And then Susan Mizellis is next. Susan accompanied Clyde in a number of the places where he engaged in forensic exhumations. One time that she did so was when he went to northern Iraq, to Kurdistan, to exhume a mass grave of people who had been killed in the Anfal, Saddam Hussein's method of trying to wipe out the Kurdish men, because he thought that they had betrayed him in the Iraq-Iran war. And then all the way to my right, to your left, is Pamela Yates, who has introduced herself already in the film. And Freddie, you were the person probably who worked most closely with Clyde in terms of the forensic exhumations. Why did you begin?
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Nayar. Well, it's a privilege to be here and speak to you about my hero, Clyde Snow. And I met Clyde in 1994 when I was, I grew up in New York and was looking for a reconnection with Guatemala. And I thought I was going to become a Mesoamerican archaeologist. And I went to see them talk about what they did at the AAA meeting, American Anthropology Association meeting. And I was a little disappointed. They weren't really Indiana Jones, as I imagined. And then I went back to my room, and I was there with the Anthropology Club, and I opened the program, and I saw this whole section on exhumations. And the first exhumation was, the first talk was called Exhuming the Past from Guatemala to Kurdistan by Clyde Snow. Circled it, and I said, I've heard of this guy before. And I looked at one of my anthropology books, and there he was, Clyde Snow. So I said, wow, I'm gonna meet Clyde Snow tomorrow. And I went, and I saw his first talk, and the first thing I remember was the first slide that was projected, back when there used to be slides, was a picture of a grave, small grave, in Guatemala, with four or five young Guatemalan aides of Clyde helping out. And I immediately knew that this was it. This was the way I was going to contribute and get involved. So I went up to Clyde and he said, well, I'm going to Guatemala next year. Let me talk to the team and see if I can invite you. So I went down to Guatemala in 1995, January, to receive a course, a two-week course, and stayed. 20 years later, I'm still doing what Clyde started me off doing, and which is using science to bring dignity to families, first of all, using science to gather evidence for trials, and using science to set the history record right. And Clyde was many things, but besides being a brilliant scientist, he was very human about the way he saw things, and his approach was always to put himself in the family's shoes. But he always said to us, if you need to cry, you cry at night, because you're a scientist before anything. And that sort of defines his approach to the way we worked. And in Guatemala, I was privileged by the fact that it was later in his life. Most of the Argentinian work had already been done. The Argentines by then were traveling everywhere, and he would join them once in a while, but he fell in love with Guatemala, so he started coming to Guatemala a lot, two or three times a year. And it wasn't till 2004 when Clyde and I were both in Guatemala. I had left for a year, and I went back for a meeting of the Latin American Forensic Anthropology Association, which is an organization we all formed. And we were in Clyde's room at the Holiday Inn, room 1209, at must have been 1:30 in the morning, finishing a bottle of single malt Irish whiskey that he'd carry with him. And he tells me, Freddie, how come we're not searching for the desaparecidos, the disappeared victims? And I said, well, you know, Clyde, as it has always been in Guatemala, the organizations in Guatemala, the victims' organizations, focus on exhuming the graves of the massacres because there's a lot of witnesses, they know where the graves are, they mostly know who the victims in the graves are, so the process is a bit simpler. And also because we don't need DNA that much for those cases. So the reality is that we don't know where to look for the desaparecidos. In Guatemala, there was about 40,000 people that were forcibly disappeared. So Clyde said, well, what cemetery do they bury unidentified bodies in the city? And I said, you know what? I don't know. But I'll find out in the morning, a couple of hours later in the morning. And he said, well, you know, maybe it happened like it happened in Argentina. So I was like, so how did it happen in Argentina? Well, they would take people, put them in, or torture them, interrogate them, and eventually kill them and throw them in the streets. Then the system would pick them up and bury them in cemeteries. Maybe it happened that way in Guatemala. And Clyde called this the Argentine footprint in Guatemala, sort of the Argentine way of disappearing people. And so the next morning, I pick him up. We had many meetings. He said, cancel everything. Take me to the cemetery. I was like, okay, let's go to the cemetery. We got lost, but we found that it was called La Verbena Cemetery, which is the one you saw in the movie, in the film. They were, Paco and Pamela were there as we were beginning. It was a lot of stars lining up for that to happen. Right? But we went there with Clyde in 2004. And we asked to see the books because Clyde told me on the way there, I bet you they wrote this all down. Let's see what they have on the books. Maybe we can find something out. I was a bit nervous because I didn't think they would allow us to see anything. But, you know, I was with Clyde, and Clyde had an aura about him. I mean, he could just walk into a room and take it over immediately. So we met with the administrator of the cemetery, and he said, listen, this is Dr. Snow. He's an anthropologist. I left the word forensic out, right? But didn't make a difference yet. He said, we were wondering if we can look at your books to see how many unidentified bodies have been buried here. Sure, come in. There's a little back room, and there was a dresser there, some shelves with locked, and he opened it up, and there was huge books about that big, labeled in years, by the year. And he said, the only bad thing is that I only have the books here from 1977 to 1986. And Clyde goes, which is exactly what we needed. You know, the worst years in Guatemala were between 80 and 84. So this was right. I mean, it was 5 years over, 5 years on. It was perfect. And Clyde reached over for 1982. I reached over for 1981, opened the books. And you could see in Guatemala, those bodies are called XX. In the rest of Latin America, they're called NNs, no nombre. Here, they would be called John Does or Jane Does. And you could see immediately 10 bodies picked up in the same day at the same location with their hands cut off or with their faces smashed. People very usually men between the ages of 18 and 35, a lot of gunshot wounds. We could both immediately see that there was a pattern there. And Clyde says, all right, tell him we need to take this information down. So we had a camera with us, an Olympus 1, is it 1 meg camera that you pretty much took two pictures and that's it, the memory was full. So I was like, oh, can we come back with some people to write this stuff down? He said, oh, sure. So we show up with 5 desktop computers and some foldable tables, and we just start writing everything down. Overall, and Clyde was there the entire time supervising. We discovered that during those 10 years, there was over 3,173 bodies buried at the cemetery as John or Jane Doe's. And once Clyde had that information, he went back to Norman and started working on it, and working on it, and working on it. He worked on it for about a year. Eventually, we published it. He did all the work, really, but he put my name on it because he was Clyde. And we published in the book Statistics for Human Rights, and the name of the article, of the chapter, is called XX Burials in Guatemala, Hidden in Plain Sight. The calculation that Clyde made was that of those 3,173 bodies, at least 889 had to be victims of enforced disappearance that were hidden as unidentified bodies and buried in that cemetery. They were thrown in the streets, and because in Guatemala, you can only identify a person if you recognize them visually or if they have their ID in their pocket, which very few people had IDs in their pockets. Obviously, they were taken out, and very few people were recognizable. And even if they were recognizable, the police and the military was at the morgue, outside, so you couldn't really go there to identify anyone. So this was a perfect system to disappear people. And once we knew that, Clyde said, "Well, I'm done. It's your time to get the bodies out." So we started looking at exhuming these bodies from the cemetery, and we discovered that, unfortunately, after 6 to 10 years, they take the bodies of the unidentified out of the ground, out of the graves, and they throw them in these huge ossuaries or bone wells, which are 4 meters in diameter by an unknown depth. And we decided that we needed two things. We needed the families that wanted to look for their loved ones. We needed DNA, a DNA laboratory, that so we can try to match the family's DNA with the body's DNA. And we needed to get to exhume the bodies from these wells. So we started, but we soon discovered that it was going to be more complicated because the identified bodies at the cemetery, which is a public cemetery, are also taken out of the above-ground crypts after about 6 to 10 years. In other words, after 6 years, if your family doesn't come and pay the equivalent of $20 so your body can stay in these crypts for another 4 years, you get taken out and you get thrown into these bone wells with the unidentified, thereby unidentifying you twice over. So we were able to get the DNA laboratory started. We have a functioning DNA laboratory now in Guatemala. We were able to conduct the exhumation. We exhumed over 16,000 bodies from four wells. The largest, the deepest and largest one was Osario number two. And I always remember Clyde, because through the years of working with Clyde in the field, he was more comfortable in the lab, obviously with the bones, but he loved the field. So I would always invite him down into the graves. But the last couple of years, he's like, "I'm not going down there. The next grave I go down into will be my own." Right? So he would just stay at the top and smoke. But when he came 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, to Guatemala with Jerry, his wife, she would accompany him later in his life because he got a little slower and couldn't move as well. She would come along, and Jerry wanted to go shopping that day, so she went shopping with Claudia and Nancy to took her to the Central Market, and Clyde came to the site. And he was at the site smoking, and there were some people there from the Smithsonian Channel, I think, filming. And I'm walking around the site, and I'm saying, "All right," and I'm talking to the camera guy. And I said, "All right, who's going down today?" And from behind me comes a voice saying, "I'm going down today, Freddie." And I'm like, I turn around, and it's like, "That sounded like you, Clyde. What do you mean?" He goes, "Yeah, I'm going down." I was like, "No, you're not. I'm going down." He's like, "You know, Jerry's going to kill me." He goes, "Yeah, well, Jerry isn't here now, is she?" So strap me up. And so we did. We put on the white suit on Clyde, the mask, strapped him up, and we didn't let him rappel down. We lowered him down, but, I mean, you can imagine what we were like. It was like, "Please, don't drop Clyde." Right? So he had four lines attached to him, and we lowered him 25 meters down into this huge bone pit. Obviously, the first thing he does is he he finds a skull with a gunshot wound that we had missed, and immediately he saw it. He says, come down here, Freddie, I want to show you something. I went down, and as I was going down, I smelled smoke because Clyde was already smoking 25 meters down. Yeah, that was Clyde. And since then, we've identified 8 people so far from found in La Verbena. The latest one is Jose Hernandez, who is case number 112 in the military diary. This was just 2 weeks ago. So Clyde was right. And he turned over, I remember when we first saw the books, and he said, Freddie, we just solved 1,000 murders, he said. And he was. It's just taking us a little longer, obviously, because we have to, the right families have to match the right bodies. And, you know, there's 16,000 bodies. So far we've done the analysis of DNA on about 2,000 of them, so it's a long process. But he was. And what Clyde started was now the entire process of searching for the disappeared in Guatemala. We were exhuming for many years, but we weren't really looking for those people that were not in those mass graves and the massacre sites. These are people that were hidden. They were taken from their homes in the middle of the night and taken to far-off locations, and now we're actually identifying them. And let me just finish by saying that Clyde was right when he said the next grave he was going to go into was his own. Because last year, in November, we had an event like this where we put a plaque of Clyde at the entrance of our office, but then we also put some of his ashes, down into Osario number 2 in La Verbena, because that's what he requested. About a week before dying, he asked that his ashes be spread out in, I think it was 20 different locations in different parts of the world. Kurdistan, El Mozote in El Salvador, La Verbena in Guatemala, Comalapa in Guatemala as well. So he was right. It is one of his many graves. And, you know, even from death, Clyde doesn't stop surprising me in the way he's looked at things and done things. So I think he must have figured that, you know, he wanted to be with those people that he was looking for. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Susan, I haven't felt a need to introduce you because I think everybody here knows you. Photographer, what's your title with the Magnum Foundation?
Moving it forward. Okay. It's a new title.
All right.
You know, that's a perfect segue. And I just was thinking, I wanted to pick up on both Freddie and Pam's film and Paco's film to say that grains of sand. And so I really want to first acknowledge 2 other grains of sand here who are not sitting with us here. Stephen Ferry, who worked with Clyde in El Mozote and Bolivia, and Gil Perez, who worked with him in Bosnia and Srebrenica. And since I'm a photographer, I actually begin with photographs. So what I want to do is just walk you through part of what Freddie just updated and spoke to and reference 20 sites, because I think really when I think about Clyde, it's he began a movement. He's so central for so many people now, and I have to do it through pictures. So in the last few days, I've been trying to find whoever could contribute, and it's been, if we had a little more time, it would be even richer, and I hope to continue it. But I think it just walks you through the scale of the contribution that Clyde made. So actually, they put it on a timer, and that's sort of unfortunate. I'm going to go back. For what I know, there may be some dates and places that are kind of not quite right. This is the FAA lab, 70s, before he joins has the invitation from Eric to join the team in Argentina. He's working on crashes that have fame, such as the American Airlines out of Chicago. He begins, this is the beginning in 1985 in Argentina, you know, photographs that are relating to the medical examiner's office and the first training of what becomes the EAAF team. The case that Aria just referred to, the Liliana Pereira case, which was essential to the first trial and conviction. This is the actual photograph from that trial showing the skull that was Liliana's. He also participated in the Joseph Mengele trial and many, many others with a group of scientists. This is one of the early photographs of that team, Mimi Doretti to the right, of Luis, who's on the right, should be here with us, as should Eric Stover, if we're really telling the story of Clyde. I mean, they're tremendously important. This is the team going from Argentina to Chile, which was one of the first initiatives, 89-90. And this comes, really, Freddie, before you there, the cliché, the first exhumations of the disappeared that he began with Eric in 1990, which is just a few moments of the from that period, including what Eric describes as a very key moment when he reveals to a judge, a local judge, the bullet holes in his skull, which begin this process of sensing that there could be trials and documentation from the evidence. This is coming from the trip 91. This is December 91, a larger story that maybe there's no time for, but really begins with URAA and Andrew Whitley calling and asking Clyde to go in across the border from Turkey into northern Iraq just after the insurrection in 1991. There's a no-fly zone of Kurdistan, and I joined that team. And it's very exploratory. We don't really know what we're going to find. The Colonel Mab flies us in a Black Hawk down to Sulaymaniyah. We document Sardau, which was behind the military headquarters of the Iraqi army. Saddam's army has retreated back to Baghdad, so it's a relatively safe zone. This is one of the first, you can see Clyde up on the left, one of the first trench graves, everyone buried properly in an Islamic fashion, quite different than dumping bones down a bone well. Again, he's already in training mode, which I find fascinating to look back and think about, Freddie, your team now, but the continuity of beginning, even in 91, he's already trying to figure out how to train the Kurds so they don't disrupt all the graves, but that they actually document a process. And that was a very key thing to systematize that collection, I think. I just always like this because those are rare moments between the scotch and the whiskey and the laughs. And there was also this, you know, sober, reflective self. Another key moment in Kurdistan when he identifies the blindfold, of course, survives around the skull of what he identified as a teenager of somewhere between 15 and 18 years. Interesting partner in this first trip in December 91, Karen Burns. She actually contributed with the first testing in the field of GPS. And the idea was that the GPS could be used to identify where there might have been earth that had been moved in some fashion from a system above. And that, I don't know really, I think it had been used in other ways. We were tracking between what GPS might have revealed as a disturbance in the earth to people who had memory, a little different than the memory you're describing, which, by the way, I was in La Verbena when the bomberos, you know, the firemen would kind of magically appear in the cemetery. But this is interesting because also the people who, of course, ran those big road machines were digging the trenches in the grave. So they had memories of somewhere in the earth, in this sector, there were possible holes to be pursued, and we were doing that kind of. So this is an example of, you know, Clyde on the top of this trench digging that came from the men with the big road machines. And then going on, Croatia, which Eric described yesterday that this was too early, it was still too dangerous to do the work. In Croatia in 92. Again, Eric also described that Clyde would go back and forth to the U.S. and actually participate in Tulsa and Oklahoma in local cases. And then these are some of Gilles' photographs of Bill Haglund and Clyde in Srebrenica, or maybe I'm not pronouncing it, Srebrenica. I always love this because he was truly a protege in every way, except I'm not sure he smoked cigars. From what I hear. And that's a kind of classic moment of I think, also important. So the documentation there led on to other colleagues taking on the responsibility, and certainly Bill was one of those. This is the Congo. the EAF team is now moved from being in Latin America, worked in Kurdistan, and beginning to work in other parts of Africa. That's the amazing seed and the growth of his vision. Working in Zimbabwe, coming back to El Salvador in 2002, and I wish we had more documentation. I'm afraid Stephen couldn't find his, and Mimi is digging right now in Mexico, so we didn't. But this is the team in El Salvador. It was a very scary time to be looking for the disappeared in El Salvador. We had documentation of the Mozote massacre, but we didn't have permission. They didn't have permission to dig, and we certainly just had the surface of what we'd seen. Interesting, he presents the Saddam Hussein trial with the documentation from Kurdistan and presents it to Guatemala. So he understands that not only he testified with the documentation of Kurdistan against Saddam, which we don't have the footage of here, but then he takes that to Guatemala to train you. So I love this chain and growth of his vision. And of course, you honor Clyde with the osteology lab, which was named on his behalf. This is Clyde you just talked about, going down, spelunking down at 83. Kind of remarkable, Freddie and Clyde. And I think this is sort of the last one. One more last. This is Eric Sober on the right. I really do wish he was here with Clyde, the whole La Bavena team. And I guess this was the last one. We just lost it. But it was really your team honoring Clyde, which I thought was a wonderful last image, just the way in which he's honored right there at the site. I don't know, that's sort of where I wanted to end, just giving a feeling of how many of us have grown from and through, you know, the training, the vision. And what Eric said last night was that not only he could love Dylan Thomas and read poetry or listen to Dylan himself, or he moved from being a specialist to being an incredibly creative visionary of how all of this came together and played a huge role in building a human rights movement, which I have to say, you two have seeded. So it's culture, the fact that there's people training to be human rights lawyers now was not envisioned in the 80s. So it just feels like this circle and these ripples and this extended community, all of whom have taken from what Clyde gave us. That's my contribution.
Thank you very much. Pamela and Paco, you decide how you divide this up.
Sure. Well, I was talking for many minutes during Granito, and I think I explained how Clyde played a central role in that film in La Verbena and in meeting Freddie. I actually didn't meet Clyde until his last few years. But one of the things I've taken with me always is, you know, he always went back to the people and the places where he had done exhumations. He always stayed connected to the places. He was always up to date on the latest in what was happening. And he was always able to connect what they had discovered and continue to discover with the exhumation and the forensic science. I always found his work to be similar or parallel, perhaps, to documentary filmmaking, and that the work, the stories are living memories. The bones that are exhumed are living memories of people. And documentary films, they have a beginning and an end, but the story starts before them and continues afterwards. And to be able to be connected, to keep connected to the stories and the people, to me is the essence of human rights and social justice work. Paco actually worked with Clyde in Guatemala before I knew Clyde.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I first met Clyde and Freddie about 15 years ago, when I went to Guatemala to do a film about an exhumation for National Geographic. And I didn't know Clyde and knew very little about him, actually. But the first night I arrived in Guatemala City, I went to the same hotel where Clyde was. I think it was the Radisson. And he was at the bar and had trained the bartender how to make martinis his way. Because actually, he's famous for the martinis more than the scotch, I would say, right? And he had trained bartenders all over the world to make the perfect martini. So that was my first introduction to Clyde. But the next day, the next morning, we went out to the site of the exhumation, and it turned out to be a 2-hour drive each way at the beginning and at the end of the day. And Clyde was such an amazing storyteller that, you know, as a filmmaker, storyteller myself, I was totally enthralled by all of his stories. Always told in a very sort of folksy, relaxed way. He had a great sense of humor. And out of these stories in the van going back and forth, one of the things that it led to was discovering who the sharpshooter was that shot down Pam's helicopter in Guatemala. Not at that moment, but he gave me the lead, and you know, from there we went on. And I'm of Spanish ancestry, and he really wanted to do an exhumation of finding Garcia Lorca's bones. So that became a thing with us over the years, and seriously thought about making a film about that. Now they have exhumed and didn't find Garcia Lorca, but he's still out there somewhere. It's still something that is sort of in the back of my mind. But the funny thing is that after meeting Clyde, and it wasn't intentional, but in almost every film we've made since then, forensic anthropology has played a role.
That's true.
Maybe not as big as in Granito, but in our film about the ICC, The Reckoning, there was one in Colombia. In State of Fear, which is based on the findings of the Peruvian Truth Commission. There I met another one of Clyde's teams, the Peruvian team, where they were doing exhumations there as part of the Truth Commission's work. So it's just amazing. I mean, Clyde is sort of the Johnny Appleseed of forensic anthropology. He just left these seeds everywhere. And now you see with the work going on in Mexico, work going on in so many places in the world, there's Clyde's stamp. His impact is incredible. You know, we all talk about the impact of our work and how do we measure it, but I think with Clyde, it's just beyond. It's incredible and hard to imagine having such a big impact, and it's going to last so long. This is going to go for generations, I'm sure. So it's just... he's a remarkable man to me. The last time Pam and I saw Clyde, well, another story that Clyde used to tell on those drives, the first time I met him, was about this little town on the west coast of Ireland that he loved to go to with his wife just to get away and think, and you know, no exhumations were going on there. And it captured my imagination, so maybe 12, 13 years later, we finally had the opportunity to go, Pam and I. And it happened to coincide with Clyde's visit to that same place. And we went to the hotel that he had talked about, a little town called Clifton. And so we were there just hanging out with Clyde for like 4 days, 5 days. And the last conversation we had with him was about the Argentine footprint in Guatemala. You know, there he was at the pub, just obsessing about that. And it was just great. It was a wonderful final memory to have of Clyde, I think.
Thank you. I think we've conveyed a little bit about Clyde's extraordinary character and his extraordinary contribution to the work of protecting human rights. We were going to end at this moment, but there are people here who have also worked with Clyde in different circumstances, and if anybody wants to contribute from the audience, we could take a few moments for that.
Yeah, I would like to mention one thing. I went last year to give a talk about human rights documentation in Colombia to the Argentine Association of Photojournalists. And there's a permanent exhibition in their little headquarters in Buenos Aires. And the first picture in that exhibition is the one that Susan showed of, I think it's by Carlos Carrion, which is this epic image of Clyde showing the photograph of the skull. So, and I think another way that his influence extends itself is through documentary photography, through photojournalism, because there's that relationship that you just mentioned, Pam, and that particular trial and that particular image was extremely important in encouraging, I think, the Argentine photographers to continue their work in documenting what happened.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Or? Okay, thank you very much for coming this afternoon, and I think it's a great opportunity to pay tribute to a great man. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.